Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Yeah, let's close the wall up with our English day.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure on this Saturday, May 3rd, 2014. And the telephone number is calling here if you if this is May 3rd where you are and you would like to interject some thought into our otherwise befuddled brains.
Yeah. And befuddled throats,
right,
for that matter.
773-1400 if you're in the East Bell County. Otherwise,
1-866-597-1400 anywhere else within the sounds of our voices.
Yeah, that was I got choked up on that. You know, it was very emotional and all of that. So stocks were up about 1% for the week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average bumped to a new record high during the week, which nobody noticed particularly. And then it went down a little bit on Friday.
Again, nobody really noticed
that. Yes, and nobody noticed it. Well, the reason it went down on Friday, and I think there is some legitimate cause to the reason it went down on Friday.
It's the same reason it went down last Friday, which is that we don't know what's happening in Ukraine on the weekend.
Yeah, Russia... I would not be at all surprised in any day coming along here to suddenly hear on the news that Russia has moved in mass as a peacekeeping mission to rescue the poor Russians and to distill the chaos that has erupted throughout eastern Ukraine. And then they will kind of move into eastern Ukraine. And from there, I don't know where this is going to go to, but it short term, Russians really don't have anything standing between them and winning. Frankly, there's a lot of economic dependence in Europe, and to a lesser extent, certainly Great Britain will. Oddly enough, Great Britain's economy will be hurt the worst if sanctions are imposed.
Right.
I just read that.
Yeah,
there's an awful lot of corporations, major corporations in across Europe, that are lobbying hard against any sanctions on Russia. And with good cause, because Russia has carefully set itself up in a position, and I do believe this was strategically set up and very conscious, to be able to put Europe into a recession. If Europe goes along with sanctions against Russia, economic sanctions, Europe will probably slide into recession, and they're weak enough in enough places that they will continue to slip and slide downhill from there. And really, Russia has got Europe over the barrel.
Yeah, and this is the maybe the last time in history that they can say that, though. Right now, Russia has been positioning itself and is in a very strong position with gas, and that's the major piece there, with gas. They're supplying Europe with about a third of their natural gas.
But they also have a lot of manufacturing contracts.
Correct.
That they have consciously underbid everybody else to make critical components in things that the Europeans export.
Yeah. And there's the Ukrainians, by the way, the largest area of their heavy industry is the part that's being looked at thirstily, hungrily.
Well, they are
by Russia.
The Russian military is largely dependent upon Ukrainian manufacturers to supply it.
Right. And that's a problem. Basically, what they're doing is carefully organizing it so that key instruments are manufactured in Russia so that the Europeans can have them. And any place that's carefully manufacturing key items for Russia, they're just invading and taking.
Right. And there is... a lot of short-term potential for mischief there. I like that. We could be seeing a run-up to something that looks, acts, and tastes and smells an awful lot like World War One or World War Two. One of the things that I'm sure Vladimir Putin is paying some attention to, but probably not enough, is it's very, very easy for these things to get out of control very quickly.
So.
And create consequences that nobody was really prepared to face.
That's really what happened in World War One. That nobody thought it was going to get out of control because diplomats were on the ground and people were talking. But once you've drawn enough lines in the sand and the sand gets erased and then you do it again, people start to lose enough faith that
well,
they
it's
say
red lines.
Yeah, red lines in the sand that with paint.
Right, or, apparently. And then if you run out of paint, you get in trouble.
Yeah, well, I ran out of paint. Sorry.
Well, on another subject that I think is probably going to irritate some of our listeners, I'll enjoy irritating our listeners. The Census Bureau's Inspector General has just completed a very thorough investigation of the economic and jobless data that was released shortly before the last presidential election, where the unemployment rate suddenly dropped.
Right.
And has found that there was absolutely zero, not a bit of evidence of any conspiracy, and he said 78 separate analysts would have had to find some way to conspire secretly across a large area where, and they
likely.
Didn't actually communicate with each other at any point. And he said that the data was really there. The tipster who set off the outcry, who was quoted by Jack Welch, among other people, and a lot of radio talking heads, lost his job because it turned out that he had been turning in a lot of anonymous tips, all of which were fake, about falsifying data.
Right.
And he apparently was interested in being paid to do so, and so I guess he gets paid to do so now because he's no longer working for the Census Bureau. But this is the point, that after a very thorough investigation, actually by several parties, there was nothing fake about the sudden drop in unemployment data just before the presidential election, and which is good news. It means that the Census Bureau is
doing its
pretty
job
much
properly,
apolitical, and that's what they found.
Which may not be the case in several other institutions of the United States government, but at least in this one, there's enough evidence in the IRS cases that at least there's a lot of smoke if there's not some fire.
Well, I read in the investigation that the IRS Inspector General had, and they apparently were targeting both sides.
Right, but one side a little bit more than the other.
Well, because there were more of them.
Could be.
And their issue was these guys are claiming tax exemption while they're doing out-and-out political activity, and the issue was to look at their names and say these are the guys we'll target because their names suggest that they are political.
Right.
Which is, you're not supposed to do that. I don't know how you're supposed to figure them out. You're supposed to ignore their names
activities. Well, you're not supposed to put, it's kind of like racial profiling in reverse.
Right.
You're not supposed to put extreme governmental pressure on a political organization, period. You're just not supposed to do that. That's free speech.
But here's the point. In order to be tax exempt, they had to be non-political.
That's not the case. They just had to be political in following the rules in their
but that's not public. It's educational and charitable. They're educational and charitable. And if it's educational,
mm-hmm,
then and charitable, then they are tax exempt. But if they become political, meaning to support a particular candidate, then they lose their tax exempt status. And the point is, you're not supposed to put pressure on political organizations, but if they are political organizations and they're claiming to be tax exempt.
And this is a problem that it's very easy to get into this. And this is an area we're going to get into some funness here. Because I have this debate with some of my liberal friends who are convinced that corporations are not people. And my answer to them is, are unions people? And they say, yes.
Hmm.
And I said, okay, so unions are people, but corporations aren't. So who are the unions arguing with? A stack of paper?
Yes, obviously.
There's paper sitting in a room somewhere that they're going in there and yelling at.
Look, if numbers can talk to you, they can argue
sure.
with stacks
yeah.
of paper.
So coming back to this political stuff, the nonprofit, the Catholic Church, Hobby Lobby, both have issues with birth. Big issues.
With birth control medication.
Well, where is the birth? When does it happen? Yeah. When is it a child? All that. So birth control. If a church, who everyone has recognized, this is a church,
mm-hmm,
can go out and on the pulpit talk about something that is spiritually powerful for this church people.
Right.
but is also a strong political movement. Is it political? Can they support a candidate that follows their spiritual beliefs? Yes, that's
not openly.
Oh, they can.
They can.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They can say this person does and this person doesn't.
Oh, yeah, but they can't actually support. They support the idea, but not the candidate.
And they can talk about the candidate and say that I agree with this person, and nobody's going. The IRS isn't going to show up and say you are no longer a church.
But they can't, as a church, for example, make contributions to his political campaign.
Correct. Correct. And that's the point of what's the IRS made some mistakes here. Mm-hmm. In that they were looking at groups of people and saying these are political, they can't be not-for-profit because they're political, when the reality is that just because they are in a realm that is politics, this is an area that the Supreme Court ruled last year about the funding for when they said that corporations were people. Freedom of speech is really, really important, and political freedom of speech is the most important part. That's what our founding fathers were all about. And I may not agree with that freedom of speech. I may not look at it and say I like what they're saying.
No, you agree with the freedom of speech. You just don't agree with what they're saying.
With what they're saying, correct. If the IRS uses keywords that have to do with a concept that is both spiritual and political as a key word, then that is a problem.
I agree.
It's a real problem.
I agree with you. The point is, though, what I was trying to make is the investigation found, they shouldn't have used the names.
Correct. That was wrong.
But they were equal opportunity
bashing on both sides of the political spectrum.
They were attacking the left side at the same rate they were attacking the right side.
But they shouldn't have been doing that either.
You and I agree. But the point I'm trying to make here is that it wasn't a situation where a Democrat or a Republican said, I'm going to attack the enemies of my belief system. They just went across the board looking for more revenue.
And I know we've got a call, but this is the thing. The person that is being the most highly castigated in the IRS for this issue, the one that the Republicans are chasing with a furor, is the one that came public with the whole thing.
Yeah, and I don't think that there's something fundamentally – well – whoever's in power, the other party's going to be after him.
Right. Okay.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, longtime listener. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal about how to spot a bubble. I'm just curious, what asset classes out there do you think are approaching or at bubble status? So hang up and listen.
All right.
Good.
How to spot
Good
a bubble.
Call. There's.
We can tell you all about how to spot bubbles. And, basically when people get really enthusiastic about something and the price of the something asset class rises above
historic norms,
it's long-term mean trend line. Now we're going to get esoteric.
Yeah,
beyond a single deviation, standard deviation.
Well, I'm going to go to – we'll go from
which means
the esoteric.
Yeah, it's about 16% over – it's trend line, it's probably in a bubble.
Well, let me go even simpler. Let me not go esoteric. Let's go simple.
Okay.
I'm going to use a very simple approach. It works very well.
Mm-hmm.
If untrained people, maybe smart, but untrained people can get into an area and make a massive profit doing it, basically amateurs, it's overpriced. and that's an easy one. You could see that in the real estate bubble when very smart people, doctors, lawyers, could go buy a house, paint the kitchen, and sell it for $50,000 more.
In many cases, they didn't even paint the kitchen.
Right. They just bought it around and sold it. That's the greater fool theory. If you think of the dot-coms, you had these physicists and very, very smart people coming in with ideas about a dot-com that was never, ever, ever, even according to them, going to make a profit, and people were buying the company.
That's a bubble. People are buying something because it's going up rather than because it has a fundamental increase in value or utility, we may not be in a bubble in that area yet, but we're headed there.
Okay, so we have an area for you all.
Right.
Two areas.
Okay.
Very large areas that we can say easily is in a bubble.
Okay, I want to hear these.
Bonds. Bonds, I'm not saying you shouldn't have bonds in your portfolio. But there are areas of bonds that are definitely in a bubble. And anytime, if you've got a lot of high-yield bonds in your portfolio, high-yield is a new and happy marketing term for junk bonds.
Yes. When they're out of favor, they're called junk bonds.
When they're in favor,
they're called
high yield.
High yield, right.
So that's an area that is definitely in a bubble. We have very, very low interest rates. If interest rates go up, the principal value of those bonds will drop. And the higher the yield, the higher the interest rate, the more they drop in those cases. Okay. Because they have to go up proportional to the lower risk areas. So that's one area. The other area, one that we've talked about quite a lot over the past several months, and this is one that's going to get people upset.
I'm waiting.
Fixed annuities based on indexes, anything insurance-oriented is long-term guaranteed at a rate that is absurd.
I don't know. It'd be hard. What that is a long-term disaster, but I don't know if it's a bubble because the valuation didn't go up. So it's not going to crash overnight. It's probably going to be a while before it blows up.
I think this isn't going to be one where it does the whole crash and explosion bubble. It's going to deflate over a period of time. The bond area, all it takes is interest rates to start moving upward, and we're going to see some problems.
Well, I can second that with some, other than our just prediction that interest rates are going to rise. The Atlanta Fed has a model that looks at employment and has been pretty consistent over the years in being predictive. And they are predicting that the United States will reach full employment, which is about an unemployment of 5.5%, possibly as quickly as 6 months into the future.
I could see that. I'd probably say more like a year and a half, but that 6 months is...
There's an article in the Wall Street Journal. Atlanta Fed suggests full employment could be reached in 6 months. It is Wall Street Journal. And it's actually the WSJ.com real-time economics blog.
If and when that happens, people will be spending more.
Mm-hmm.
They will be saving less.
And interest rates will go up.
Interest rates will go up. And the reason why I can say that with some surety is when people save less, banks have less money.
Mm-hmm.
That means when they give a loan to someone, they have less money to do it with, which means supply and demand. They have to charge more for the money. The way they charge more for that money is with interest rates. So interest rates will go up. When interest rates go up, bond prices will go down.
There's some other news to do with that that's not quite as thrilling, and that is sometime out about 10 years or less from now, the unemployment rate could easily, in this model, drop to 3-point-something%.
Yeah.
Now, that you might say that's great. It's not.
Not necessarily great.
Because that produces a job shortage. I'm not a job, a labor shortage. We've already seen skilled labor shortages. Otis, who's the largest manufacturer of elevators.
Right.
And part of United Technologies, which if you look at it, they make lots of stuff. Moved their major manufacturing facility that was in Nogales, Mexico before, moved it to South Carolina.
Right.
And they did so because they did a lot of calculations and concluded that with the wage declines, particularly at the lower end in the United States, and the rising wages in Mexico and the transportation costs and everything else together, it would save them a lot of money and raise their productivity a lot to move back from overseas to the United States. Well, that was a couple of years ago.
And now they're looking at going back.
No, they're not. Well, actually, what they had to do is they had to leave their Mexican facility open much longer than they anticipated. But here's the problem that they ran into when they got back to South Carolina. Apparently, no more than one company did this, by the way. They couldn't find enough skilled workers, and they had to move people in had to pay people to move in from across the country, which really now they're actually coming up to speed there now in South Carolina. But in order to do so, they had to hire people from all over the country and pay them a lot more than they anticipated paying because, very frankly, they could not find skilled. It's not an absence of desire to work.
It's the skills in that area.
Engineering, math, machinists.
Programming.
All the
customer
things
relations
that you need to build a good elevator, They're running about 2 years behind now, or about a year and a half, I'm sorry, behind on their project. And the reason is because we already have labor shortages in the United States. And we have labor shortages because we don't have enough educated workers.
This is two more examples, quick ones. People moving from Silicon Valley, corporations moving,
setting up
to Texas, in Austin.
Right.
Two very well-known corporations, Facebook, Google, went to Austin because Austin has this great pool of educated workers. They showed up, they opened up, and couldn't hire enough people. Google had to hire 400 headhunters, basically, people that go around looking for people to hire. They did not expect to have to do that. So when we're talking about the areas that we're excited about, the areas that the growth is going to be in, we're looking at an area that there are people that are needed, that we need to get educated in that area, and there's still a big pool of people looking for jobs. One of the issues that has been good for our economy is that we've had unemployment paid to them during that time period. And part of the goodness there is that they've been able to go to school and retrain for something else.
Right.
Part of the badness is that some of them, or a lot of them, did not. They did not retrain. They wanted to keep doing what they were doing, and those professions may not exist anymore.
Right. Well, professions is a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, those occupations.
Right.
Those areas of work may not exist. You cannot get a job putting hubcaps on wheels anymore in a manufacturing facility.
Or,
a robot is doing that.
Well, that's not the hubcaps so much as it is bolting on the fenders.
And robots are doing that.
The other repetitive issues.
That used to be a highly skilled job.
And the Atlanta Fed report, by the way, had another comment, and that is unless we get immigration reform.
Right.
And that means overhauling the immigration system, which, by
one
the way,
into
there's
the
a
other.
Lot of objection to doing from the right and the left. They have a completely bipartisan desire to keep the broken system in place.
The unions don't want it because then the union labor is going to get hurt by these new people that are coming to work. Mm-hmm. And the extreme right wing doesn't
they don't want
it.
Foreigners
they
coming
they
in.
Don't want people from other countries coming
right.
in and so on,
and
even
we,
though that's where our ancestors came from, too.
Not my ancestors, maybe your ancestors.
That's right. We both actually should compare our ancestry. Wait a minute.
I am your ancestor.
You are my ancestor.
Anyway, the issue is, of course, that we really do need a complete overhaul of our immigration policies and laws, which, by the way, were put together in the 1920s and unduly favor Eastern European countries.
Right.
We basically need to back up and say, Canada, by the way, has a lot of warts and pimples. They got them all over the place. A lot of things wrong in Canada.
Medicine for that.
But
their healthcare system's a little problematic,
right,
so they have problems getting those medicines.
And their healthcare system is a disaster. But they do have a good immigration policy, which basically says if you either have a whole lot of money that you're willing to invest in Canada, or you have skills, high-level skills,
come to Canada,
which is, by the way, why Microsoft moved one of its facilities to Canada.
Right.
Because they couldn't get enough skilled people, couldn't find them anywhere in the United States, and Congress says, oh, no, with unemployment this high, we're not giving you a bunch of visas to let people in.
And this is important. I know we've got a call waiter waiting, but...
You got a call waiter? Yeah.
Historically, countries that allow skilled immigration at high levels do a lot better economically than others and continue to do so for generations into the future.
I wonder why.
That's a good question.
We need to probably put a study on that.
Yeah, let's study that. Why is it that if you
it's
allow skilled people
to... It's far better
to
allow somebody's cousins to come in. You call her on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
I just have a quick question relating to 401ks and IRAs. She's retired, but she's got an IRA. I've got a 401k. At some point in time, I'll be retiring. And can you combine two with two two different individuals. Is there any advantage to that if you can do that? And if you can't do that, that's fine. I just didn't know if you could.
It's a very short answer to that.
Very, very easy answer. No.
No, you can't. It's why it's called an individual retirement account, is because it's an individual. Now, you can combine them. There's one way that you can combine them flawlessly.
I want to hear this.
You got to cash one out, pay the taxes.
Well, no, that's
you can do that.
That's not flawless. That's expensive. Die. Just die.
Even that, you can't do it. Okay. It has to be in a beneficiary IRA.
Yeah, well, but
it still
has
the other person's Social Security number. Yeah, but you still have two account numbers.
Yeah, but the same person has both of them.
Right. Well, then the same person can have them both.
Right.
But no, you cannot combine them ever.
So all you have to do is die, and you can sort of combine them.
Yeah. Well, you can put them under both of your names.
Answer I was looking for. My wife says you need to die.
Solve that problem.
Got that one right out of the way. See, piece of cake.
She'd be happy to hear that if I ever tell her.
Well, yeah, but in all reality, one thing, when you do retire, don't leave it in the 401k.
Right.
Put it in an IRA. If you like the funds you're in the 401k, that's beautiful. Just
find those funds in the IRA.
Find those same funds and put them in the IRA, but do not leave it with the corporation.
The corporation has to manage that money as if it's yours. However, it is technically the corporation's. And if they decide to change management of their 401k, you can be locked out of access to that stuff for a very extended period of time.
And if you are out of contact with them, and when you're retired, there comes a point when you don't pay a lot of attention to your mail, believe it or not.
They can move your stuff around.
They can say, we just changed providers, and because you didn't respond to us, we put it over here. And then it can get worse. If you don't respond to them long enough, they just turn around and give it to the state.
Yeah, that's kind of nice of them.
Then they're required by law to do that.
Very charitable of them to turn around and give that to the state.
So,
very nice.
Yeah, and people say, well, why not leave it in the 401k? You know, don't have to mess with it that way. And the answer is you're placing a lot of bets on that company not changing anything, and the chances of them not changing anything for a long period of time are pretty slim. Far better to take responsibility for it, move it into an IRA. If you got a lot of money and you don't know how to handle your IRA, and most people don't, hire an investment advisor. And I do mean, and I'll be very frank, I know that I have a dog in this fight because we are an independent fee-only investment advisor. But you hire an independent. I want to say this again, independent.
Well, I'm not sure that there's enough research available because from the conversations I've been having with people lately, the number of people that claim to be independent that are not independent but claim to be independent is pretty staggering. There's a lot of people out there that claim it.
Basically, I'm going to tell you something that is my subjective judgment after 30-plus years as a stockbroker, everything in the financial services industry, and now where we are today. If you want to have effective investment management, and do-it-yourself is generally not particularly effective, at least not what I've seen, it's really important that you hire a registered investment advisor who is registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. Now, why?
At the very least, the state.
Well, the problem with the state is that means they don't have much money. And if they don't have much money under management, it's, you know, if you're so smart, why ain't you rich sort of deal.
That's true. It is true.
And they're probably a startup or a newbie. And believe me, this—the guy where you got one guy in an office who is the investment manager. I mean,
and he talks to you at the same time.
And he may be this greatest guy in the world, but if he gets sick, or if his one employee doesn't show up for a few days, or if he's on vacation, I mean, there's just a host of your risk of that person's failure goes off the scale. And the other thing, of course, and I'm getting into a little bit of detail here. If you got a standalone guy who is an investment advisor and he's the guy that's managing your stuff, sooner or later that guy is going to retire and he's going to sell your stuff to a corporation, and then you're going to either have to take whatever the corporation gives you or start all over again. If you have a firm, and there are a lot of good firms out there, not just ours, that is an independent non-broker dealer, this is crucial. In other words, they don't sell things. They don't sell insurance. They don't sell stocks. They don't sell mutual funds. They strictly exist from what their clients pay them as fees.
Now, this is key. You should be able to see exactly what you pay them on a regular basis. You should see it coming out of statements. You could, you should see that. If you don't see that,
if you get any product that they're not charging you a fee on, and you can't see the fee,
then that's not what they're doing.
Then they're
somebody else.
They're earning money on it. They're earning enough. They're not going to tell you what it is. And this is a guy who's got about 100 pages of double-spaced print studying this subject that I'm about to submit for publication, and I can tell you, for peer review, and I can tell you that even after 30-plus years in this environment, I have been astonished at what even the supposedly reputable firms are doing as a matter of routine and are proclaiming as a matter of routine. I thought I was beyond being astonished at what is normally done by well-known organizations and companies, but I'm shocked on an almost daily basis now. Again, if you don't have a lot of money and you need to use a good broker, a good high-quality guy in your local hometown or what, and you're willing to pay the commissions and he'll talk to you about the commissions and tell you how much you're paying him, fine. But once you get to the point where you're retiring, you have enough money in your 401k you've got enough money in your 401k and you haven't retired, and getting somebody to assist you in managing it, who will charge you a fee and tell you what they're charging you, and not at the same time be working for a sales organization like a broker dealer. Somewhere at the bottom, there is a disclaimer that says securities offered through something, 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 member, FINRA, SIPC. If that's down at the bottom of the page someplace, then it's a sales organization. FINRA regulates securities sales organizations. If they're in the business of selling life insurance, then they're in the business of earning commissions, and they're human beings, and they're going to go with the highest commission they can get away with. I mean, that's perfectly normal, rational, economic behavior, is to get as much money paid to you as you can for doing a given job. There's nothing wrong with that. But as the person who's paying the money, it probably is not in your best interest to pay the maximum amount of money possible to get a given job done. So there's an adversarial relationship anytime that you're not working with an independent registered investment advisor who is not affiliated with or associated with any organization that sells stuff. I mean, that sounds fairly simple, but it's just astonishing to me. By the way, if somebody calls themselves a financial advisor, they are a salesperson working for a sales organization.
Or they could be you. You could call yourself a financial advisor.
But I don't.
No, I'm not talking about you, the listener.
You said you.
I did say you. But by you, I meant them. Them you, not you you.
You you.
You you. Anyway, you as a listener, if you give somebody advice on, I think you shouldn't pay 35 cents for that can of soda because you can go to Costco and buy it for less, you are now a financial advisor. That's the extent of training that you need.
Yeah, you're a financial advisor. That's right.
Congratulations. You have now given financial advice. There are certain laws that cover investment advice. Investment advice is actually covered under a law called the Investment Advisors Act of 1940.
Which is very poorly enforced, unfortunately.
Yes, poorly enforced, and most people don't know the difference between an investment advisor and a financial advisor. In fact, if I had talked to you 5 minutes before listening to this portion of the program, you would have said, what are you doing talking to me instead of being on the radio? And then I would have said, oh, I shouldn't be talking to you. No, but you wouldn't have known the difference either, probably. Yep. Financial advice, investment advice are very different things.
Well, we're going to play some commercials, which constitute a form of financial advice, and we'll be back on the other side after these commercials from KTEM.
May 2nd, 3rd, and 4th.
And And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I hope you enjoyed that financial advisor talk that we had, that the commercial guys had just then.
Right.
You know. Okay. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hello. I want your input on SunGas, which is, I think the last I saw was $21 a share. On SunGas, so your input, what about it?
It's an individual stock, and it is a random gamble. That's my input on it.
Yeah. I couldn't even understand what the... Could you turn down your radio?
Okay, I've got it. I've turned you back down.
Okay, yeah. What was the name of the...
SunGas. The issue is that, anybody that will give you an opinion on a stock like that falls into one of several categories, one of them which is if he really does have input that other people don't have, then it's insider trading and it's illegal. If he's looking at exactly the same data that everybody else is looking at, then what the person is doing is saying, I think I'm smarter than everybody else if I give an opinion on it. And it's just a guess. So when it comes to individual stocks like SunGas, you're gambling. And you're rolling the dice because no matter how much, and this is, you're talking to a guy here who's been in this business for over three decades, me. And I used to be a stockbroker, a very, very well compensated stockbroker, much higher compensation than I have today as an investment advisor, which should tell you something because I got my money from commissions.
Way back then.
And I can tell you that I tried my best to be the best stockbroker anybody could find, read everything I could find on given companies, made my best guess, took services, paid a lot of money. And when I independently evaluated the portfolios that I put together and sold to my customers, they would have done better in most mutual funds, which is why you don't get long-term evaluations of your actual performance and expenses and everything else. The bottom line to it is, from a stockbroker, the bottom line to it is, if the stockbroker was smart enough to be that good of a stock picker, that he was better than a good mutual fund manager, he wouldn't be a stockbroker, or she wouldn't be a stockbroker.
He'd be a mutual fund manager.
They'd be making the seven figures that the better, the good mutual fund managers make millions of dollars a year for being good mutual fund managers. And if a person is talking to you and you're the average investor and you're not investing millions of dollars, then by definition, that person is not as good as one of the top 20% or so of mutual fund managers in the United States. That's just a reality because the top 20% or so of mutual fund managers in the United States make more money than the bottom 80% for themselves. And that's just a reality. We were serious at the Personal Wealth Coach. We're very serious about investing. And as a result, we do what Harry Markowitz said to do. We use mutual funds. Why do we use mutual funds? Some of them are index funds, I'll admit, where individual fund managers cannot historically seem to do better than in the index.
Some indexes, right.
On certain we use asset classes, and each asset class is typically related. You know, there's multiple indexes that fall in that asset class. And when we find a situation where individual managers can't beat the index, well, we will use an index fund. Most of the asset classes we use, there's about 5% of the managers who consistently over long periods of time outperform the averages, outperform the indexes. Well, we oddly enough, we have a tendency to use those managers. But when it comes to investing in individual stocks, if you're out there in the woods trying to do this, you are competing with people who have computers that make decisions in nanoseconds, who do qualitative and quantitative analysis all at the same time. You're in competition with them. And the issue is they're going to win.
Well, if you're doing short-term trading, on your other end, you're doing competition against Warren Buffett, who's buying individual stocks, but he's buying enough of the stock that he actually gets some control of the company.
Mm-hmm.
So that if his team comes in and says this company could be served better with the management team that I have built over the past many decades.
By the way, did you notice who he selected as his heir apparent?
I didn't. Who is that?
He made the announcement. His oldest son.
Oh.
Which nobody who, by the way, serves at least part-time as a volunteer deputy sheriff.
Oh, well.
And nobody really had, he was off everybody's radar. Nobody even considered that. But he is going to be the guy that if Warren kicks the bucket, steps in and takes over management. Man, that, I don't know how that's going to work out, but I can really understand his position on that. Anyway, you said Warren Buffett and kind of set me off. Yeah. Anyway, that's the position we take. We are devotees, of a sense, of a guy named Harry Markowitz. He's not perfect, but he's just the best that's come along so far, who wrote a paper in 1952. And his paper has been cited again and again and again since then. He got the Nobel Prize in 1991.
Yeah, well, the thing is, he really wrote one good paper.
Yeah, and after that,
really
he's kind of slid down. But he's
not
defended
done
that
anything
paper
since
ever
then.
Since.
He wrote it in 1952, and but it's kind of his crowning achievement. He did it in college, and
they're
since
still
then,
paying for him.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good deal.
As long as he gets paid for it. The point is that he wrote this paper, and he said there's a way of investing that's predictive over the long term. And you know what? He was right. And paper after paper and study after study have validated what he wrote again and again and again. Now, man, are there a lot of people out there who don't like that because they want to be smarter than the market. And he says you don't even try to be smarter than the market. You just look at 30 years of stuff, set everything up according to that, and stick with it. Now, the 30-year window moves around, so as a result, we move around what we're doing. But it is a really, that's the baseline. We use about three different principles, but that's one of them right there. But he said use mutual funds. Why did he say use mutual funds? Because if you use individual stocks, you're competing with professionals. Not generally a good idea in the real world. And the second thing is, unless you've got a really, 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 really lot of money, and we're talking about at the minimum $100 million, you cannot adequately diversify and hire people to diversify across individual stocks, which is why, but if you get into a mutual fund, they typically have over $100 million and they've got really, really smart professionals. Anyway,
we just got the jobs data came out for April. It was in, during our program right here. Yeah.
No, it came out before, I think. Well, 288,000 jobs?
$288,000.
But that one, no, that was a couple of days ago.
I thought that came out, well, it came out Friday, last night. It came out after the close of the market last night.
Yeah, May 2nd at 7:12 p.m. is when the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah. And so that's it. So but
you've got a very slow computer.
Yeah, my computer's
obviously
a little slow. Okay. But anyway, that's an important thing. That's 288,000 jobs.
That's what I was talking about earlier.
That is the largest job growth in multiples of years. That is
about 3 years.
Right. Also, if you look here, the unemployment rate dropped to 6.3%.
That's what I was talking about earlier.
Right. Okay. You mentioned these things. And I heard you say them, but the numbers didn't register with me.
They weren't talking to you.
Right. These numbers weren't talking to me. There's some important factors here.
Some numbers talk to you and some don't.
6.3%. There was a time only about a decade and a half ago that they thought full employment was 6%. We're at 6.3 right now.
Well, 5.5 is considered full employment now.
Right. What that means is that we are
0.8%.
Yeah, we are moving along very, very quickly to not only recovery, but growth in the economy based on where we were at the beginning of the recession. September of 2008, which is the labor market really hadn't had the impact that it would have later.
Well, that was about when things started going down here.
Right. The unemployment level was 6.3%. Yeah. Which is what it is now.
Yeah, but it's a different, and this is one of the things, by the way, that's being discussed out there. It's a different 6.3%
right.
now than it was
there
then.
There are people that were working then that have completely left the workforce then, and we've had growth in, so basically, we're going to see more people coming in. That's what this big number means.
But we'll probably see the unemployment rate go up. And the reason I say that is because there'll probably be people who want to come back into the workforce. But let me tell you, this is a big unknown. Why in the month of April did we see 800,000, we created 288,000 new jobs. Wonderful. Great.
Right.
But in the month of April, 800,000 people who were looking for jobs in March stopped looking for jobs in April.
Right.
Now,
so the
where did they go? We don't know.
What's being measured in these numbers is the, I've got to put air quotes. How do you put air quotes on the radio? Air quotes going in for this one. The workforce is being measured. Okay, so what is the size of the workforce? We don't know.
Well,
nobody knows.
We're at about 62-point-something% of the population.
Right.
The adult population.
Well, this is the question is, and the reason why I say nobody knows, is that if you tomorrow, you being the listener, decide that you don't want to work anymore, are you still in the workforce? Well, tomorrow you aren't, but is there an email that's sent out to somebody at the Bureau of Labor Statistics? No. They think maybe you're looking for another job. Wait a minute, he's just disappeared, or she's just disappeared. So that number is an unknown. It's a big estimate, and we're pretty good at the estimates, but we're off by some significant amounts, particularly in times around recessions, where people leave because it's too hard to keep looking for jobs, and then we're off again when those people come back into the workforce and they say, I don't want to stay at home and raise the kids anymore. I want to go back to work.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a couple of factors that have showed up that seem to be contributing to this. One is the boomers simply retiring. We're my generation. I am a little ways into the lead end of the boomer generation, and I'm 64 and will be 65 this year.
That's a big reason why that 806,000 people left.
A lot of people, as they hit 66,
that's Social Security.
They can draw Social Security, which it's actually called the full retirement age. It used to be called the federal retirement age.
It's only for you, though, because a few years younger than you, it's 67.
Yeah. And so the issue is when people hit that age, a lot of people looking around and said, I'm making a living, but if I just back off and start drawing Social Security, I can maybe live on that. Now, does that mean that there's going to be a lot of that go on? No. There's another factor, and that is a lot of families have put off raising kids, and they're decided, and this is a fascinating thing. You know, there's an awful lot of stay-at-home dads now.
It's true.
And this is mushroomed. And the reason, if you look back at the education data, which I did, is that a few years ago, there was a sort of a flurry of information. Women were getting the hard science degrees
right.
more than men. Men were slacking off.
College.
Women were getting the harder degrees. So the women are
not just harder
earning
degrees,
more money than the men in
not,
many cases.
Not just harder degrees. The percentage of women with college educations is higher by far than the
yes.
percentage of men with college educations if you're below the age of 35. Which means that the higher earning power is going to be in the women. So there's a lot of men that stay home now.
Right. And so there's some shifts going on in the economy. Now, if we reach the point where we have wages going up, we'll probably see more people enter the workforce. The reason and one of the issues, and this is a real issue, and a lot of people don't like to pay any attention to it, but at the low end of the scale, we're paying people less than we were a few years ago.
Correct.
I just want to make, we're about out of time for the second hour here, but I want to make one comment before we get off the air. Last week we were talking to a loyal listener, and he was saying that the younger people don't have a good work ethic, and I kind of disagreed with him. We had a guy who worked here who was our engineer, sort of, in the show before us, and he's gone on, probably found a better job. He was working three jobs 7 days a week to raise his daughter.
Right.
Young guy. Another guy who's in here today came walking in and he said, what do you mean lack of work ethic? I work 7 days a week. You know, you may not see the people with the work ethic because you're looking at people who are out of work.
They're working. That's why you don't see the people with the work ethic because they're at work.
I was kind of made sensitive to this, and I looked around, and there's a lot of people in the Gen X, even Gen Y, who are working 7 days a week, three jobs. So don't think the work ethic isn't there. Anyway, we're about out of time for the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to leave a message for us on the weekend or talk to a live person during the week, 947-1111 is our telephone number.
You can reach it toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 1-800-914-PLAN. You can reach us by email at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can also go to our webpage, tpwc.com or thepersonalwealthcoach.com. You can listen to podcasts or you can send us a message. Until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
KTEM. Serving Central Texas, KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.